This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit, and it's time for our weekly recap edition. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined in studio by the show's producer, Carey Jr. II.
Happy Friday, Stephen.
Friday could not have come any sooner this week, given all the things that have happened. The news cycle is accelerated and crazier than it was 2 weeks ago, than it was 6 months ago, and I kind of fear that it's going to be like this,
right?
At least until November, if not till after.
I feel like we've lived about a month in the last week and a half. It's been so crazy.
Like,
the news cycle has been spinning, and this week I feel like your energy has been like, "F it, we're doing it live. We're just going to do it live. We're going to cover it. We're going to figure out how it all plays out.
Do it all live.
Do it all live." So
yeah. I mean, we had to respond early this week to the big news on Sunday, which was that President Joe Biden suddenly, or maybe not so suddenly, decided that he was not going to continue to seek re-election. And of course, it came at the end of a week in which the Republicans had gathered in Milwaukee for their national nominating convention. So you had this kind of double barrel of of big news. And we spent the week, much of the week, talking about all of that, all of these things. And so that is that's what our recap really kind of circles around this week. We've got three segments that we think were really kind of standout examples of the kinds of discussions that we had on Created Equal.
Yeah, once Biden withdrew from the race, it kind of snowballed into more news. As he said, it followed the convention. Then after he dropped out, he endorsed his Vice President Kamala Harris. And so there was a lot of topics for us to discuss for the week. So it kind of those segments for this recap center around those three topics. But we're going to start with the conversation about Biden withdrawing. That's, as you said, was the big news from Sunday. And so Biden, of course, did not pursue a second term in office and instead endorses Vice President Kamala Harris. And so we really wanted to ask, what happens now? We did preview that a little bit in last week's episode, kind of a hypothetical situation if Biden were to step down. So this week we decided to go full on into that discussion, talk about all the possibilities, potential open convention, what it would look like, how chaotic would it be. I mean, we had two great guests to help talk us through that.
And remember, look, voters selected Biden to be the nominee, millions and millions of Democratic voters. That means, you know, you've got to find a way to, I guess, satisfy the Democratic urges there, that people have an expectation that what they did should matter. How do you do that once the nominee kind of steps aside and says, I'm endorsing the person who was supposed to be the vice president? And there still is, I suppose, at least the specter of an open convention, which is something that we talked about a few weeks ago. But we had two great guests to talk about this this week. Professor Matt Dalek is a political historian at George Washington University. He had joined us before to talk about this idea of an open convention and the history of the nominee selection process. Also with us was E.J. Dionne. He is a professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown and a longtime columnist for The Washington Post who has covered many, many presidential elections. So, E.J., I am going to start with you, principally because I know how long you have covered presidential politics in Washington. Tell me just first your reaction to what happened, but also give us a sense of how Democrats sell this idea to all those voters who came out during the primary and thought they were making a decision about who the nominee would be.
Well, a couple of things. One is I've been around so long that I covered Joe Biden as the new generation candidate back in 1987.
Yeah.
You know, he had to drop out that year. And he made a very compelling case, by the way, at the time that it was a good time to move on to a new generation. So I've known him for a long time, have real affection for him, and actually think he's been a really good president. My reaction was one of, in a sense, elation, I got to say, because, you know, after the debate at the end of June, it just seemed to me pretty clear that he wasn't the Joe Biden that many who voted for him in that those primaries, and I was one of them, thought he was, that, perhaps we were deluded, but we thought he was ready for this campaign and could move on. And it wasn't that it was a bad debate. It was that he was sort of missing moments. Something seemed wrong. And so I think for a lot of people who really liked Biden, and indeed people who wanted him to protect and defend his legacy, it turned out that the best thing he could do was to drop out. It's ironic, really, because Biden, you know, said he ran a second time because he thought he was the one person who could defeat Donald Trump. And I think in the end, he realized that the best way for him to defeat Donald Trump was to drop out of the race and open it up to another candidate. Right now, that candidate now seems inevitable. It's Kamala Harris. And that was perhaps predictable before this happened. If you talk to a number of the people, as I was doing in Congress, who wanted Biden to drop out, a lot of them wanted to move on quickly to Harris just to get this campaign rolling again. And you also saw a lot of potential rivals, Governor Whitmer of your state, notable among them, Governor Shapiro of Pennsylvania, just saying, we're not going to contest this race. We endorse Kamala Harris. So it's a fait accompli. I still think for sections of the party, it would be good to show that, you know, this is not simply somebody arranging this behind the scenes. This is a whole lot of Democrats, elected Democrats, delegates who decided the best way for the party to move forward is to move on. We'll see how that plays out in the next few days.
Yeah. Professor Dalek, I'm going to bring you in here in the conversation. You and I had a conversation just a few weeks ago here on the show about the prospect of an open convention, which back then I think was something that seemed possible. This is how quickly the news cycle in this election is moving. The table looks very different in front of us right now. But I want to have you talk about this process, how this will work, and I guess how it should work. What is the inclusive or democratic way to replace a candidate this late in the process?
It's such a great question, and it's also one that's really hard to answer, because since really 1972, the parties have operated through this democratic primary process, small d, meaning that the voters get to decide. And now, really for, I think, the first time since then, in decades, a candidate has dropped out very late. And so we're back to a kind of pre-1972 era, to some extent, at least, where several thousand, in this case, delegates. Now, as EJ said, right, these are elected officials, they're elected delegates. You know, these are not sort of a small group of white men in the smoke-filled room, per se. So I think they have a real stake, a real claim to being reflective and representative of the will of the voters, but still people are not going to get to vote and nominate Kamala Harris per se. So I don't think that there is a great answer to should. I mean, I think the party is sort of feeling its way as best it could. I'm a little, not totally surprised, but just a little surprised at how swiftly people have rallied behind the vice president, given that she, you know, at least her poll numbers are not super popular, right? She's underwater as well. And there are obviously a lot of other prominent Democrats, including the governor of your state, who some Democrats, I think in an ideal world would be better a position to go after Donald Trump and to defeat him. But I think a lot of Democrats And a lot of Democratic officials are saying, you know, we don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good.
Sure.
And there are, of course, real risks to having a kind of open or contested convention. And so, you know, it looks like it's going to be Vice President Harris, and the party seems to be rallying behind her very aggressively.
Yeah. So
could I just say something?
Go ahead, EJ. Yeah.
I broadly agree with Matt on what he said. You can't have a contest if the other people in the contest, potential people, don't show up.
Right.
And I think that what's clearly happened here is that the big potential players that everybody was talking about, Governor Whitmer, notably Governor Shapiro, others, made a decision probably before President Biden announced, because you could see this coming. I thought it had become inevitable by the end of last week, when, you know, a whole bunch of Democrats came out, 12 on Friday, saying this is over. That they decided that for their long-term interest and also for the interest of the party, their jumping in the race would probably do them no good, would create more division than the excitement of an open convention. I always thought there was a lot of romanticism about open conventions. The Democrats in 1924 had 103 ballots. Mm-hmm. That was as open as a convention could be. And the Democratic candidate, a guy we've forgotten called John W. Davis, got less than 29% of the vote in the general election. So open conventions are not a miraculous cure for anything. But I think they just decided, no, this is not the right time for us to run. And so they fell in line behind Kamala Harris. And now it's very hard to see who could turn this into anything like a competitive race. Somebody might come along, but it doesn't, I don't see any obvious person to do it.
Yeah. So here's the big question that I guess I have. If you're a Democrat who voted in these primaries, I think the question you might be asking today is, if this was what was going to happen, that the president would step aside and endorse his vice president for the position, why not do that last fall when Joe Biden came out and said, "Oh, you know, I'm going to run again. I'm going to seek the nomination." That would have given voters the chance to select either Kamala Harris or any of these other potential candidates that people are talking about. And I think the process would have at least seemed a lot more open, a lot fairer. And so I think, you know, I mean, I get what's going on, and I get that the president is probably in a different position in terms of his physical and mental soundness now than he was last fall. But it does seem like that, you know, that decision last fall to go ahead and run and not step aside for Harris, it could end up hurting them, I guess, with some of their own voters. What do you think, EJ?
I think in retrospect that the premise of your question is right, and I didn't think so at the time. So shame on me, I guess.
You felt like Biden was the right choice.
I thought Biden had it. I thought he could carry it through. And I thought that he was somebody who could pull what is often a very divided party together. I mean, I think what the paradox of the end game here is that Biden was the best guy, a person, to hold together a party that runs from center, you know, all the way over to the left. And they're both, all factions were broadly comfortable with Joe Biden. By the end, he was dividing the party between people who thought he should stay and people who thought he could leave. In retrospect, I think the premise of your question is right, that it would have been better if he had said, "I'm not running again. I said that I was a bridge," you know, as he said in 2020.
Yep. Yep.
"And I've had a lot of successes. I've achieved what I needed to achieve. I defeated Donald Trump, protected democracy. I'm going to be the best president I can for the rest of this term, and let's have a contest." And would that have been, in retrospect, a better way to do it? I think the answer is yes. I think one of the questions that we haven't answered yet, not we here on the call, but information is not fully clear on, is how much of the deterioration of Biden happened in the last 4 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. And how much of this should have been obvious to the people around him last year? There were a lot of people around who were calling him on him not to run. And a lot of them are saying, with some justice, we were right about that now. But I think there is, at least my impression, and my impression in talking to people is that something happened, something accelerated here in the course of 2024 that led to that debate moment. And I hope we can learn before the great historians like Matt have to get to it, exactly what was going on here, because I think that's one of the big mysteries.
Yeah, yeah. Professor Dalek, I'll give you the last word on this before we have to break. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I remember distinctly having a conversation actually with a historian friend of mine in May of 2023. And I said, you know, Biden running again is a real risk. And he said, but Biden not running again is also a real risk, because you don't know who you're going to get and if the party's going to fracture. You know, I think Biden actually, with the information he had in, let's say, last year, late last year, probably made a reasonable decision, especially if the deterioration was, as EJ was saying, and that's my impression too, more recent than it was, say, a year ago, because I was under the impression that Biden could do this, right? That he was very vigorous, quite sharp. He was, you know, making reasonable judgments. He could unify the party as EJ was saying, and he seemed, you know, ready to go. And he had beat Trump once and gotten a lot done in his first term, been a very effective president. So I think he had a really strong case, but you know, I think he made a somewhat reasonable judgment, but it was also risky. And it turned out that in some ways it backfired. And, you know, we are where we are. And that debate certainly mattered, right? It gave people a ton of new information about him. And really it confirmed the critics, right? His Republican critics and others. It confirmed their worst opinion of him. And I think that was extremely damaging, and it was obviously not recoverable.
Yeah. That was Professor Matt Dalek of George Washington University and E.J. Dionne, who's a columnist for The Washington Post and a professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University, talking about what comes next for the Democrats now that Joe Biden is out and Kamala Harris seems to be in. All right, coming up, we're going to revisit a roundtable analysis of the state of the Republican side of this presidential election. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined by Kerry Jr. II. Next, we want to revisit a roundtable we had this week where we discussed the state of some of what's going on the Republican side of the presidential election. Of course, they had their national convention last week before President Joe Biden made a big splash with his news that he would step aside. We had a pretty big roundtable, Kerry, of folks in studio to talk about that. Andrea Bightley joined us. She's a political and communication strategist at Bightley Communications. She is the former spokesperson for former Republican Attorney General Bill Schuette. Sarah Hubbard was with us as well. She's a Republican regent at the University of Michigan and a principal at Acuitas, which is a political consulting and lobbying firm in Lansing. Nancy Kaffer was with us. She's the editorial page editor at the Detroit Free Press. And our own Russ McNamara was here. Mm-hmm. He's a reporter and host of All Things Considered.
Yeah. A large slate we have for that roundtable.
A lot of voices.
Yeah, I mean, the conventions are a big deal this year, specifically for us as well, because we had, as you said, Russ McNamara go and visit the convention. Of course, former President Trump spoke. He also chose his vice presidential running mate, J.V. Vance. And J.D. Vance, excuse me. And so there was a really good conversation. I think there was one point at the beginning, at the early part, where Sarah Hubbard, the Republican regent for the University of Michigan, made a comment about Kamala Harris being one of the more liberal candidates we've seen. And that's kind of where this clip starts off. So I'm going to throw the clip to let Sarah say what she had to say, and then we'll get right back to it.
So Republicans are worried about that. They're worried about impacts on taxes. They're worried about, you know, the liberal policies that Kamala Harris is going to bring to the table. She's already shown herself to be the most liberal candidate we've ever had for president, or at least in a long, long time. And Trump is going to certainly expose those differences between his policies and what she's talked about.
I think a lot of progressives would disagree with that.
Yeah, what's the part of her platform or outlook that you would describe as being the most liberal in presidential history, Sarah?
Well, she's been talking about in her past campaigns, as well as her time as the vice president, things like open borders, Medicare for all, increasing taxes, you know, a lot of different things that may be foundation of the platform there. But, you know, I've seen some clips of her recently that have come to light that are definitely in a different place than I think where President Biden has attempted to be in his leadership.
You and Nancy did not let Sarah make that comment without a bit of a retort there.
It was a little like, we're like, wait a minute. That's right.
And so a caller as well felt the same way. So one of the callers from that episode called in, and he's kind of the beginning of this clip. So we're going to go ahead and tune into this episode and listen to what he had to say.
Hey, Stephen. Good to see you. Good to hear from you.
Yes.
I have a couple comments and some questions for your guest.
Okay.
First, the guest that made the claim that Kamala Harris is the most liberal candidate we've ever had. You know, the mendacity of her answer, you know, with the perfidious comments that had no substance to them. Oh, I've heard things. I've seen things. She's open borders and health care for all. Hey, health care for all. That was Mitt Romney, wasn't it? Okay, second question. How come there was no question at the Republican convention about how a convicted felon is your freaking candidate? Are you kidding me? There was no question about that? No question at all about any of the charges against him ever? No, it's just like, hey, it's just, you know, every day this is what it is, you know. The misogyny that is present in the Republican platform and in, you know, the whole MAGA idea, I mean, it's coming out. And we're also going to see couch racism, too.
Yeah. Anka, I do really appreciate the call and the questions. Some of them I have the same questions. But first, before we get to the rest of the panel, I want to give Sarah Hubbard a chance to respond. I mean, she was the one who did say that she felt that Kamala Harris is the most liberal presidential candidate in presidential history. Sarah, do you want to respond to what Anka's saying here?
Yeah. Well, I think that Democrats are going to embrace that for the most part, right? She's energizing the base already. She's getting lots of support. She's claiming that she's raised more grassroots funds than I don't know if it's ever or in a long time, a few days ago. So I think she's doing the things that her base wants her to do. I, as a Republican, am saying she is very, very liberal and is going to bring those issues to the table. You know, I think it's interesting that some who will support her are now concerned about that. I think that's exactly what the base of the Democratic Party is looking for, is the policies that she's bringing to the table. So we'll see how that plays out in the election.
But I guess the question is more specific, which is how is what she's saying more liberal than what other Democrats have posited in the past? And Anka's example is great. This idea of healthcare for all, Medicare for all, that was largely a Republican idea for a very long time. It wasn't just Mitt Romney who embraced it. There were several others. So what is the policy that you're thinking of that moves her more left than other people?
I think she's talking, though, about things that go more left than where President Biden has been. And that's what I'm seeing, and I think the contrast that people are going to draw. Sure, Medicare for All is an issue that's been around for a long time, but it's not something we've seen talked about recently in any significant way out of this administration, and something we think that she'll bring back to the forefront.
So the thing is, you know, most elections are decided by the people in the middle, right? And
this one will be too.
When you look at voter enthusiasm, it's been really high on the Republican side. It's been high-ish on the Democrat side, not as high as the Republican side. And among independents, Richard Shuba from Glengariff Group, whose polling is just fantastic, his last poll found these results. And among independents, it's trailing by a lot, right? And so these are moderate independents by nature. If they were not moderates, they'd be members of one party or another, right? They're kind of in the middle. And moderates sort of want that middle ground. So we're going to hear a lot of this. We're going to hear Kamala Harris is the most liberal candidate ever. She's going to bankrupt us. She's going to give everybody health care. She's going to open the borders. Just like we heard that about Joe Biden, like we heard it about Hillary Clinton, like we heard it about Obama. I mean, I'm sorry, with all due respect, Sarah, this is a Republican talking point about whichever Democrat is the nominee, because it's effective language to cue to the moderates who will decide the election that this person is not right for their values. And it doesn't necessarily relate to the actual positions of the candidate at question.
And I think it's pretty interesting because Anka mentioned how, you know, nobody's really talking about Donald Trump being convicted of 34 felonies. That is something that everybody seemingly has embraced. The ones I talked to, the merchandise available with a, you know, mugshot on T-shirts. Pastor Lorenzo Sewell of Detroit's 180 Church, mm-hmm. he talked at the RNC and talked about how after Trump got convicted, it was a banner day for fundraising immediately after that. There's this undercurrent of it's kind of persecution or a conspiracy against Donald Trump that kind of runs in some fringes of the Republican mm-hmm. Party, and some of those have really embraced that.
Our polling with Epic MRA has consistently found that there is a percentage of Michiganders who say that they would be more likely to support Donald Trump if he had been convicted of crimes, which he now has been.
Yeah. Sarah and Andrea, I really want to get your response to that issue as well. This idea that, Donald Trump has been convicted of 34 felonies and faces a trial for many more. There's a lot of argument about the fairness of that process. But, you know, in the end, a conviction is a conviction under the system of laws that we have. How does that square with his candidacy, and how does it square with his candidacy for a party that is the more conservative, the law and order party, supposedly? Andrea, what do you make of that?
Well, Trump lost my vote years ago, to be very honest with all of you guys. And Stephen, I actually said that on your show pre-January 6th, uh-huh. that I hadn't voted for Trump and I had no intentions of voting for Trump. So I think what it comes down to is people need to decide if they're willing to vote for someone who's been convicted of financial crimes, has been successfully sued for sexual assault allegations. I'm personally not willing to do that. I had fully intended on voting for Joe Biden. Now I have to evaluate whether I will choose to vote for Kamala Harris. And I mean, frankly, with her, it comes down a lot to who will she select as her vice presidential candidate. I have my favorites. But depending on who that VP pick is, will make me more or less motivated to get out and check that box.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah. I want to get Sarah's reaction to the Trump criminal problems.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting thing how Republicans are choosing not to talk about it. I don't disagree that this is a real issue and would have a significant impact on, from a precedent standpoint, having someone like that become our president that has that kind of history. But I do think a lot of Republicans view this all as a political maneuvering. I believe in our system of laws. I believe in our courts. But a lot of Republicans are dismissing it to some extent because they think that it's still largely political and pointing toward some of the legal maneuvers that aren't working out.
I mean, I think one of the questions is really about how independent voters will react to that. I mean, again, it's the voters in the middle who will decide that, this question in Michigan and around the country. And is it risky, I guess, to have someone who was convicted of 34 felonies at the top of the ticket when you're trying to get, you know, independent voters who are not necessarily party loyalists to think that. Sarah, what do you think?
Well, I think it's the candidates we have right now. So that's what independent voters have to evaluate is, or is Trump or is Harris going to be the person that they have greater trust in taking this country in the right direction? And when you talk about Michigan voters, immigration is a little bit different for us here in Michigan, because we think of Canada as the country, you know, right next door to us, where we are very friendly and they're one of our greatest allies. And we're very interested in immigration from them, which is very different than how Texas and some other southern states might look at immigration. I think the other thing independent voters in Michigan will look at carefully is the impact in the discussions that both Trump and Harris are having about electric vehicles and the automotive industry. As we're so reliant on it in Michigan, our voters are going to have to decide whether they think putting the big bet on EVs is right for the future of Michigan and right for the future of our automotive industry. And we've seen our own industry rethinking that in some ways as well. So where does that take us?
Go ahead, Nancy.
So, yeah, getting into that point right there, one of the points in the GOP platform was to stop the forced EV transition. And again, old-fashioned Republican here. I'd like to see our companies be able to make those choices and not have the government weighing in at all and creating those incredibly binary choices for companies. You know, we're seeing General Motors do some pivots right now. I think these companies should be allowed to do that. And getting involved deeply in the forced regulatory process is something that I don't want to see either political party do. So I'm very interested to see what the Democrats are going to say in a couple weeks at their convention. And I'm very interested to see how Trump and Vance continue to discuss electric vehicles, because as we saw at the Republican National Convention, the head of the Teamsters was actually a prominent speaker on one of the nights at the RNC, which blew my mind as as an old school Republican.
It was a head scratching moment, right? You're like, am bizarre. I watching the right channel here?
Right. But at the same time, we've seen more and more blue-collar workers, union members, shifting over to that Trump populist message. So while it was surprising to see the head of the Teamsters up there, that gets down to who the Trump RNC was going for. They were going for the blue-collar worker, the folks who may have seen themselves left behind as we have moved into a more technical society.
Go ahead, Nancy.
And that's, you know, we're in the middle of a coalition shift, and we have been for the last 8 years, right? Like, if you're, I'm almost 50, if you're my age, the coalitions that come together to elect a particular candidate have been pretty fixed for my entire life, even if you're a bit older than me. But that's not, you know, that's not true. That's not a home truth. Like, these coalitions change pretty regularly, and I think we've had a pretty long spell of a pretty cohesive and defined coalitions on both sides. But we're in the middle of this change where people who, you know, kind of represent, like Andrea was saying, blue-collar workers are more inclined to Trump. We're seeing, you know, Republicans used to be the party of elitism, but as Mark Grebner, political consultant who knows just so much about this state, says that, you know, now if you're in a neighborhood where people realistically have a chance of sending their kids to the University of Michigan, they're probably Democrats. And 20 years ago, that would have been Republicans. So we're in the middle of a big shift here, and I don't know where it's leading. And I'm really curious about how some of this is going to break out. In that polling I mentioned earlier about Americans supporting mass deportation, there have even been some polls that found that a significant number of Hispanic voters are are for this.
Yeah.
So we also have to not have assumptions about where people's policy preferences will land, in as much as policy matters at all, really, here. We have, you know, part of Trump's platform is that he's going to get rid of inflation by imposing a 10% tariff on import goods, which are, those are not things most economists would tell you are possible. But most people don't want to think or talk about tariffs or get into that. So policy is tangentially important to the conversation here.
Well, and as Kai Rizdahl from Marketplace likes to remind everybody, that a tariff is just a tax on Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. So You mentioned that shift, Nancy, and it's really fascinating because, especially with the labor movement, you know, Sean O'Brien, head of the Teamsters, is already going to be facing a challenge within the Teamsters because he ticked a lot of people off. The UAW immediately came up with statements. SEIU came mm-hmm. up with statements. And these are people that automatically just rallied around Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. So while some blue-collar workers have definitely shifted towards Donald Trump, the unions themselves are still staunchly on the side of Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, it's leadership. Yeah, go ahead, Andrea.
Oh, I'd be interested to see what the disconnect is between union leadership and yes, union membership.
That's exactly what I was going to say, that you've got leadership united almost universally behind Democrats, and they were going to work really hard for Joe Biden, I know, because of his unprecedented support of the auto strikes last year, the first time we saw a president really get into the middle of something like that. But it's the rank and file, right? The members that you don't have, you know, an easy way to determine whether they are listening to leadership or looking at their pocketbooks or other things and making their decisions.
But also important to remember that only about 11% of workers in the U.S. are represented by a union.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's all workers, including white and blue collar. So I don't know what the breakdown is on what percentage of blue collar workers, but I think there could be very different politics when you start to unpack that. Yeah.
That was our roundtable discussion about the state of the Republican side of the 2024 presidential election. Coming up after a break, we're going to conclude our recap looking back at a conversation that took a closer look at who Vice President Kamala Harris is. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. More Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined by Kerry Jr. II. So throughout the week, we saw a number of people, seemingly everybody, endorse on the Democratic side Vice President Harris as the party's nominee. We saw Barack and Michelle Obama finally do it at the end of the week. But that doesn't tell people who Kamala Harris is, what she stands for. Mm-hmm. She's been vice president for 4 years, but that's not a position where you really get to introduce yourself to the voters in the way that she will over the next couple of months. So we wanted to have a conversation about who she is, what kinds of things she believes, what kinds of things she might do if she were elected president. And Kerry, you took care of this one for us this week.
Yeah, I think once we knew that Kamala Harris had overwhelming support from the party and enough delegates at least pledged to her to get the nomination, we wanted to take a closer look at who she was and how that might inform the type of racial run over these next couple of weeks. And yeah, we spoke with I spoke with Elaine Plott Calabro. That was a great time. She is a political journalist and staff writer at The Atlantic. And so we had a conversation about kind of her temperament and the things that she believed in as we reevaluated how she'll approach this race. Elena, thank you for joining me. Good morning.
Hi, Kerry. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Awesome, awesome. So let's kind of get this started off. You followed Kamala Harris for some years, and you've written about her for some years. Tell us a little bit about her temperament, who she is as a person, what you kind of got a feel of from her by following her in her day-to-day life.
Well, it's a great question, but it's a complicated answer, in large part because Kamala Harris is a pretty guarded politician. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a lot of sense when you think about where she started her career. She mm-hmm. didn't start as sort of a stump speech politician. She was a prosecutor first in Alameda County, and then the district attorney in San Francisco, then attorney general in California. So if you think about your own district attorney, it's not the sort of person that you're looking to for warm and fuzzy, soaring speeches about democracy or anything like that. It's, you know, it's very black and white. It's very data driven. That's what politics was for her. And so now that she's been on the national stage, I think a huge transition for her has been into sort of those gauzier elements that we expect as voters from our national leaders. Mm-hmm. So as I spent a lot of time with her on the campaign trail, it took a great deal of time before I felt I was able to get kind of past the surface with her. You know, finally, in our third interview, we sat down in the vice president's residence. And once she was in her own territory, you really saw her finally let her guard down a bit. And I found her to be almost maternal, Carrie. I mean, at one point, she looks at me and she says, "So you're newly married." And it wasn't a question. And I had not told her this, but I just said, "Yes, Madam Vice President, I am." And she said, "Pay attention to your marriage, your relationships, because life has a way of sweeping you up." And I just thought it was a really powerful moment that you don't experience often, as I'm sure you know, as a journalist with a politician. But it just, I guess I just want to emphasize, it really took time to get there with her. And so when I hear voters, you know, report on the trail and they say to me, "She just doesn't seem authentic. I don't really know what she's about." You know, that is something she's had to overcome and try to give voters more of that instant sense of connection in a way that somebody like, say, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama were able to.
I'm always reminded by the saying that you want to sit down and have a beer with your potential leader, whether it's a governor or a president. And it seems like that's always kind of been our barrier with Vice President Harris. Did she say anything? Did you ask her, I guess, about that and why it is she may appear to be guarded in that way? Is it purely her profession, or is there something else that she knows she's trying to make sure she's fitting into this role and doing her job the way she needs to do it?
So one thing she said to me, which I thought was interesting, was, "My career has not been about giving lovely speeches. It's been about doing the work."
Execution.
Exactly. And so, but where I think that gets, you know, complicated is that a lot of the ball game as a national politician is a lovely speech. And even if you are doing the work, however excellently behind the scenes, if you can't necessarily communicate that in a compelling way to a broad swath of Americans, it almost doesn't matter as much. You need Americans to hear what you're doing. But so much of her career has been behind the scenes. I mean, I remember talking to one of her communications directors from her time as district attorney of San Francisco. And she said, even then, you know, Kamala Harris would win a tremendous case that she had just really done a beautiful job. And she would say, "Let's get this in the press. Let's get you out there and talk about this." And she'd say, I can't. I'm on the next case. I'm busy. And so that does matter a little bit less in those offices where the people are closer to you and it's just more easy to see day to day what you're accomplishing. Mm-hmm. When you're as far away from the average voter as the White House, that things like communication and rhetoric do become a lot more important.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there anything in the work specifically that you think informs her ability to be a candidate for president in terms of her prosecutor or attorney general past?
Absolutely. I think that especially coming up on a debate stage is where I think Americans will really see Kamala Harris in her element. If you recall, the thing that really launched her into the national consciousness, I would say, was her questioning of Donald Trump nominees to the Supreme Court, like Brett Kavanaugh, cabinet picks like Jeff Sessions. That was a moment when this was a brand new junior senator from California. And a lot of Americans said, "I want to know more about this person." When she can take control of a conversation, as I've seen time and again at events, she's a very, very compelling politician. And I think especially in this truncated period of time when the campaign is going to be less about her and more about what can she convince Americans of her opponent?
Right.
That, I think, is just, you know, a really useful environment for her to be in.
She's going to prosecute the case against Donald Trump, right?
Exactly. And I was talking to one of her former comms directors the other day, and they said the bumper stickers write themselves, "Vote for the prosecutor, not the felon." And she, my understanding, she really plans to lean into that message for these next 3 months.
Yeah. And so is there any element that you believe, like, will she adopt the personability element for this? Do you think she'll just kind of say, like you said, this is a short period of time. I know what my sweet spot is. It's to get really specific and to go at the facts, not flower it up with kind of being this really approachable person. Will she maybe try and balance that out? Do you have a feeling for that?
You know, what's so interesting about that question is that, you know, I watched her campaign announcement speech on Monday from the headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware. Mm-hmm. And I tweeted this at the time, but I was struck by how of the dozens and dozens of Kamala Harris political speeches I have watched over the years, I have never seen her more confident. And here's why. I think that 4 years sort of at the height of defund the police rhetoric, the post-George Floyd moment, we are back in an America where a lot of voters are moving to the right again on crime, on these ideas of law and order. And for her, I think that is it just matches with her career in a way that's always just felt more natural for her. And it's the reason I think her 2020 primary campaign flamed out before the first vote. She really had no idea how to sell her prosecutorial background in a way that felt appropriate to a Democratic base that just was not looking for that at the moment. But it's almost like the moment has come back around to meet her, I think, and her strengths. And I think she's just settling into not even a version of herself, but just really herself in a way that I certainly haven't seen on the trail before. She finally has advisors saying to her, go be yourself. Your background is what people want right now, particularly with an opponent like Donald Trump, who is, again, a convicted felon. I mean, it's just the moment seems tailor-made for her skill set in a way that it hasn't been really for a lot of the past 4 years. And so I think that approachability will just naturally come when she is just acting more comfortable in her own skin and in her own instincts, if that makes sense.
That was Carey Jr. the second talking with Elena Plott Calabro of The Atlantic, a political journalist and staff writer there who has written about Kamala Harris for years and wrote an extensive profile of her recently. Boy, that last statement she made, Carey, really speaks to the kind of momentum that I think we're the early momentum, at least, that we're seeing behind the Harris news. In other words, the number of people who seem excited, the things that the party and the campaign are doing to kind of highlight her personality and highlight the contrast between her and Donald Trump. I think the Republicans have a real challenge on their hands in terms of what do they run against here, whereas with Joe Biden, it was kind of a fish in the barrel in the sense that, well, he's just too old, and he seems too old, and he can't do the job. This is a more complicated,
right?
This is a more complicated challenge for them.
Well, I'd imagine they would choose a path that does not go at her character as much as they would Joe Biden's, or her age as much as they did Joe Biden's, and probably tie her to policies. I think what we saw in that roundtable too with Sarah, she spoke about like how she made the comment about Kamala being very liberal. There might be an approach where Republicans will try to paint this candidate as being a very progressive candidate. So I think there's different tactics that the Republicans will try to take.
But they got to find their footing And it seems like, at least in the first week, they've had a hard time doing that. And they seem to be, flat-footed and playing defense as opposed to pushing their message, which is, I don't know, it seems like coming out of your convention, that should have been your strength, is now you've got your ticket, now you've got your message, and you're going ahead. Instead, they seem to be trying to avoid the punches from the other side.
Well, I don't know if it's 100% just them either, because as what Elena was saying with Kamala, she's still got to find her footing in herself, right? She's got to figure out what her message is and how she's going to relate to the public. So I think both parties are still kind of in a place of finding what that final push
that
was going to look like,
yeah,
and getting into the rhythm as the election comes around. They did just have a whole candidate drop out. So Democrats are still trying to figure their things out. They did unify behind a candidate, as we've seen so far. We'll see if she's actually going to be the nominee.
Well, and she's got two important tests ahead of her.
Yeah.
The first, of course, is the convention, which is in a few weeks.
Yeah.
That's got to come together the way that it should. It needs to seem unified and craft a message that they can go forward with. And then, of course, her pick for the vice presidential nominee, that is going to mean everything in this race. And that, I suppose, it could come early, but at the latest, it'll come at the convention. And those are two big opportunities for her to introduce herself again in a different way to the American voters.
Yeah, it's very kind of uncertain race we're going into now. It's all over the place.
I don't think anyone has ever seen anything like it so far, and it's only July. Four more months before the people vote. I can't imagine what else might happen in order to sort of frame this race. It's a cliche to say it, but we are witnessing history as it happens. So
unprecedented.
It's all really exciting. Okay, that's going to do it for us on Created Equal. Remember, you can listen to recent episodes of our show at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our engineer is Nate Bender. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.